On a different dimension, I believe the pandemic has served that to all of us. It's shocked us, but I'm looking at my world of work differently. I'm not going to give up. You know, I want the freedom of my time with my family and my kids and not commuting. I'm not giving that up. And never before in history have we had a moment where that's happened.
Welcome to Be More, a podcast by Peakon. This is where everyone at an organization can hear different and meaningful perspectives on how we can all thrive in this ever-changing and constantly evolving world of work. I'm your host, Patrick Kornoyer. Steve Cadigan is joining me today, and he is a talent strategist and company culture expert responsible for building world-class teams and company cultures. Steve is a talent advisor for many global organizations, including Google, Salesforce, and the BBC, which inspired me to reach out and ask him to share his insights on mentoring, specifically his perspective on how effective mentor relationships work and what to consider when choosing your own personal mentor. Steve shares with me a personal story today about the most meaningful mentoring conversation that he had after leaving an executive leadership role at LinkedIn, and how one question in that conversation shifted his perspective on the future. Steve, thank you for joining the conversation today.
It's great to be here.
Yeah, I'm excited. So you're a fellow podcaster as well, so in the opposite seat today for you. But let's start out with a bit of your journey. Tell us a bit about you, your journey, and specifically a bit about your passion for the work that you're doing right now. It's a quick introduction to the audience.
Well, I've had a pretty well-traveled life in some respects. While I was born in the US, I was raised for the first 5 years of my life in South Africa. My parents were rebels and they wanted to experience the world and really try and learn new things. So when I was very young, my first year of school was in South Africa. We were kicked out in 1970 when I was about seven and settled, and I grew up in Connecticut. I landed in a university with no plans at all. I had no idea why I was going to university when I went in, and I had no plans what I was going to do with my life when I exited the university. I chose history as a major because it was the only thing that I liked, but I had real no idea what I wanted to do. And as my dad's a minister, my mom was a social worker. So I had no real desire to go and to do what they're doing. Loved them and loved how they're helping the world. But I wound up in San Francisco after graduating from a university in Connecticut, and I followed love. I was in love with a classmate who lived in California. And so I'm going that way for love. And that's why I wound up in California. It was a beautiful adventure. I'd never been to California before. A lot of the climate reminded me of South Africa. But here I was, again, in a new environment. And this adaptability at a pretty young age, I think has served me well and has been something that I've tapped into over my career. So I'll get to that. I stumbled into human resources about a year into working in a fashion company and fell in love. I've always been a big sports fan. I'm an athlete. I love competing. But more than that, I love watching how people handle competition and how they handle being a team player. And when I realized someone's going to pay me to put teams together and develop teams and coach people and grow them and build something greater than they could do on their own, it was just love at first sight. And I feel incredibly lucky at age of 23, 24 to have stumbled on that. And for the next 20 years, I moved to different industries. I was fashion, then insurance, and then I got pulled into Silicon Valley in the mid-90s when things were just booming. I worked in a chip company in varying progressively bigger roles of responsibility in the world of human resources. And then I had a big breakthrough, a company that at the time was one of the most valuable, successful companies in tech, Cisco Systems, asked me if I would like to help them build an acquisition integration team. They were a very prolific acquirer. And over the next 4 years, I integrated 50 companies. And we were so successful at doing that we were written up in the Wall Street Journal and Fortune magazine. And I loved it. What I loved about it, having been a traditional HR generalist most of my career, was that in that traditional role, you are gardening, you have seasons and you're working on something, but it really, there is no end. You're always trying to make something better. And in M&A, it was like beginning, middle, end, onto the next deal. And it was closure. There was, you know, finite measurables that we could use. And I really like that. And it's also the most highest velocity change experience anyone could go through. If you get acquired or if you've been merged, you know the feeling. It's very different. Everything's just a jump ball. Do I have a job? Are they going to relocate me? Same boss? Are they going to mess with my money? Do the benefits line up, and you know, with a new company and so forth? And my job was to stabilize that. So, and I love the craziness of it. I love the challenge. And then the dot-com bubble burst in 2001 and my job went away. So they said, what do you want to do? And I said, I want to go to Europe. And they said, how about Asia? And I said, Norway, Finland, Sweden, UK, France. I speak a little French. They said, how about Singapore? I said, okay, get the message. And I took a job to be the head of human resources in Asia. Now, to be honest, Patrick, I had no idea where Singapore was on a map. I'd never been to Asia. I thought it was the province of China. And so I went out there completely, you know, just naive to everything. The nuance of culture, the history, and it was an incredible adventure. And I was there for 2 years and it was incredible. After 2 years, Cisco said, you're coming back. And I said, no, I'm not. And they said, yeah, you need to come back to headquarters. And I said, no. And they said, yes. And I said, okay, well, let's agree to part ways. And at the time I was recruited by a company in Canada. So the first time in my life now, probably 20 years into HR, I'm a first-time head of human resources. Never wanted to be that. Never met anyone who ran HR that I wanted to be like. I never saw people have the lifestyle I wanted. And I learned more about how I didn't want HR to work than how I did want it to work, which is why I liked M&A, because I didn't have to follow any rules. I was a rebel and I was a rule breaker, not a rule maker. And now I had to be the rule maker as a first-time head of human resources in about a 15-person publicly traded NASDAQ-listed company headquartered beautiful British Columbia. So I did that for 4 years, loved it. But it was the post-dot-com bubble. Everyone was experiencing a stock option hangover. I laid off more people than I hired. And it was really, really hard times. And the culture was just one of depression and sadness because the stock had been 250. When I walk in the door, it's 12 bucks. And so everyone knew what they could have been worth. And now they're like, mm-mm. And so that was hard, but it was good, challenging work. And I loved it. But then my boss retired. I got recruited back to the United States by Electronic Arts to do M&A work again. I wasn't going to be the head of HR. And I was so excited to work in the entertainment industry. Woo, video games, playing guilt-free. And about a few months into it, 2008 economic recession hits, banking crisis, EA's money disappears. We can't go buy companies. And my job basically shriveled up to be something that wasn't interesting. And that's when I got a knock on the door and it was LinkedIn. And it's the first time I'd ever been offered an opportunity to join a pre-IPO startup, 400 people. I'd heard of it, but I was like, I don't know. My parents were like, why are you leaving this great company, Electronic Arts, to go to some, you know, fragile startup that like end up like most startups in the can? And I took it and we scaled it from 400 to 4,000 4 years. Incredible IPO. One of the most successful on many dimensions, and tackled something I'd never done before, which is build a company. And was able to apply so many of the mistakes I'd made and the lessons I learned along the way. And so I did that for about 4 years. It felt like 20, if I'm honest. It was just incredibly dramatic. I was the only executive with three young children, which had all been born outside the US. So I have a Singaporean and two Canadians. And you can kind of tell because the Singaporean's kind of warm to the touch and the Canadian's a little cold. Dun-dun-dun. And so after about 3.5, 4 years, I decided I was exhausted and I wanted to be more of a dad. And fortunately for me, LinkedIn had done so well that I had enough savings that I could do that. And I said I would never retire-ish until I had saved all my kids' college tuition and I had owned my house and I was able to achieve those things. So I was like super, super proud. And so I did that with no plan. I just left. And then the last 10 years, I have started to tune and fine-tune where I want to play and what I want to do. And now I help people, leaders, and organizations build what I call compelling talent strategies. Like, how do we think about work today? And how do we think about hiring, recruiting, and motivating in new and insightful and compelling ways that really achieve great outcomes? So that's sort of, you know, my journey in a nutshell, if you will.
That's great. And as we continue learning a bit more about you, the conversation this season, as you know, is all about mentorship and individual stories about experience with being a mentor and being on the receiving end of mentorship. And your background, you have a vast background. Like, you have experience, as you said, with building cultures and building organizations, and that story of acquiring 50 companies, and that is a lot. It is, one acquisition is a lot, let alone 50, and different company cultures and how they all integrate. And so you have a lot of business experience, but also an amazing personal journey and experience over your life. You've had many cultural experiences. So as we talk about mentorship, let's start the conversation off with your experience, your personal experience with mentors. Have you had mentors in your life? And what's been your experience with mentors?
I have. And a reason I was so excited to have this conversation with you is that I don't know that I've ever sat down and had this conversation with anyone. And I think I'm excited that you're tackling this because it's a worthy topic, worthy of exploration, particularly in a realm of work right now that is more confusing, that is less certain than at any time that, you know, there has been work. We know less about the future than ever before. And we also see more of what's possible from a career path. We have more people changing careers, pivoting than at any time in history. And LinkedIn has contributed to that journey because they've made transparent what's possible, that you can have an incredible journey without necessarily having a college degree, or you can have been a brain surgeon and then become a data scientist and so forth, or you can be a historian and find your way doing M&A work in a high-tech company. So I've had many mentors. And if I think about it, I don't know that I ever said, hey, can you be my mentor, and formalized it. It was, most of my mentoring were moments in time, maybe a few months. I don't think I've ever had a mentor that's been consecutive years. And that's probably because I've been a bit nomadic in my journey, different industries, different countries, and different places. And I was telling someone the other day who was visiting me, I said, you know, I live here in Menlo Park, but I'm never going to run into someone I went to grade school with because they're all in Connecticut. And just, I'm not going to see someone I went to college with. Most people from Connecticut don't move out here. And so, you know, but I've been here over 20 years and I have, you know, I've coached a ton of kids' sports and I've made some friends. But I will share one experience that was the most, probably most pivotal moment in recent history for me, which was leaving LinkedIn. I didn't have a plan when I left LinkedIn to leave. I showed up to work one day. I had a meeting with my boss. I was exhausted. When I was home with my three young children, I was never home. And I was, this rat in my stomach of guilt was just growing. Like, something's missing. Everyone thinks on the outside, you're so successful and you're on this incredible journey. But I was miserable inside. I wasn't feeling good about my parenting. I wasn't feeling good about being there for my family. And what hit one night, my son said to me, it was a Friday morning. And this was a week before I left. He said, Dad, are you going to be home early tonight? And I was like, oh yeah, I'm definitely going to be home early. He said, 8:30, 9. And that just broke my heart that my son saw my pattern of coming home on Fridays at 8:30 or 9. And that he was, 6-7 years old at the time and shouldn't even be staying awake that late waiting for me. And I got to change. Things are just not working. And I'm financially in a place where I can make these choices. So I left and I didn't know what to do. And I had a friend that had done some coaching for LinkedIn. His name was Gustavo. And Gustavo was a very just engaging Argentinian thought leader, Gustavo Rabin. And I'd helped him compose. He'd written a book and I'd been a sounding board for him. And it was the first time I'd ever been on the jacket of a book cover saying, hey, it's a great book. And I thought it was pretty neat. So I had an evening with Gustavo that I'll never forget. And I showed up to his house and I said, hey, I just quit. He's like, what? He's like, wow, that's really interesting. You did. And he was excited for me. And I thought he was going to react the way my family did and way a lot of my friends. Like, what? Why are you getting off of this rocket ship to the moon that's so sexy and seductive? And I said, no, I'm not feeling it. And so he said, okay. And he talked to his wife, said, I'm going to take Steve to dinner and we're going to go have a conversation. And I had had many discussions with him about life that transcended work. And that's where my affection and my respect and admiration for him, I loved how he thought about people. And he packaged it in this Argentinian English accent. And it was just, he was kind of my Yoda. And I don't know that I ever told him that, you know, and he passed away a few years after this moment, unfortunately, really, really quickly. And I'm still recovering from losing that. But he, if he were alive, he would definitely be someone that I would be in touch with. But the choices he made, the lifestyle that he had, how he thought about problems, how he made the complex seem simple and achievable really appealed to me. And so I went to him, and over the course of dinner, we arrived at basically what I'm doing today, still today. And he said, all right, I want you to tell me when you feel most alive as a human. What are you doing? And I'm like, no one's ever asked me that. Like, when do you feel most alive? Like, it's usually packaged in what's your passion or what are you really good at? And that's where the depth of someone from a different culture was this beautiful question. I was like, whoa, okay. And I thought, and what was important for me in that relationship and this for the audience is my comfort and my, I would say my love for him just dropped my guard, made the integrity of that moment very, very high and the quality high. And my guard was down. And that's when I think we're at our candid best. Some people may want to have a mentor who's flashy or has a title. I've seen this mistake happen too many times because I want to tell someone that you're my mentor because I'm going to look good, that you're like, that you're mentoring me because you've got a fancy title and a fancy company. That's the wrong way to look at this because you're going to spend all that time trying to impress that person and trying to be something that you think is going to impress that person. And that is a formula for disaster. And I've done that. I will admit I made that mistake earlier in my career. What I felt here was I had nothing to lose right now. I'm financially secure. I don't need to impress anyone. And he, and this is a beautiful moment for me in the next few years after that I left LinkedIn, was for the first time in my career, I'm meeting someone as Steve Cadigan, not the VP of M&A at Cisco, not the VP of LinkedIn. And when you're in these high profile roles, these high profile companies, people want to stick their claws in you and say, well, I'm doing business for such and such great high flyer company. And so, and it's never an authentic connection. And I'm really, I mean, I'm a Scorpio. I'm an ENFP, Myers-Briggs. If you're not authentic, you're dead to me. Like I can't handle it. And it's like nails on a chalkboard. Gustavo was that and more. And so that moment of trust, my guard was down. When do you feel alive? When do you feel life? And I said, well, I don't know how to answer that question. I said, but when I am teaching, and when I'm speaking, my hair will stand up on my arm. He goes, that is the essence of life. You're feeling in your blood. And I almost started crying. And I was like, I need to do this. And I never thought of myself as a teacher or a speaker. And so I'm like, all right, I want to learn, you know, how to do this more. And I know there's people that will listen to me because my career has allowed me to gain a little bit of attention and credibility to open the door. So how can I do that? And so that, I mean, here I am, you know, 10, 15 years later after that moment, and it really stood out. And I think for those reasons, right? The trust that I had for him.
I really share a lot of what you just said, perspective-wise. And first off, thank you for sharing that very personal story with us. I mean, that's what I love about these conversations are when people share their experience, their personal experience, because I truly believe that that is encouraging for people. I feel it's inspiring for people to hear how just people experience life in different ways. The other thing that very much resonates with what you just said, in a previous episode, I spoke about one of my personal mentors. Her name is Deb McHouston, and I very much care about her. And you talk about having your guard down. She's not only a very dear friend of mine, but she absolutely is a mentor for me, specifically with my career, but just life in general. She's a life mentor for me. And when I think about the conversations that I have had with her that are the most impactful are the ones where my guard is down, where I'm not trying to impress her. I'm not trying to... It's not about impressing anybody. It's about being very real, being honest with myself, which then in turn allows me to be very honest with her. And the most productive mentorship conversations I've ever had with her have been in those circumstances. So I really share that perspective with you about if choosing a mentor and when choosing a mentor, maybe that's the more effective way of saying it, is to really think about how you can be in with yourself when you're in this relationship with this mentor. Because if you can't be yourself, if you can't be honest, and you can't be vulnerable and have that guard down, the effectiveness of that relationship is really not going to be what it needs to be. And I think your story on that is such an example of that, because as you said, maybe at the time you didn't realize that it was this very pivotal mentoring moment for you, especially that one conversation that stands out in your head, which was almost, what, how many years ago? 15 years ago?
Yeah. And I think what's worth diving into a little bit here is I wasn't in a place where I felt I would make myself that vulnerable earlier in my career. I was struggling to grow and impress and, you know, climb. And I think, you know, at the point that, you know, where I am in my journey, where you are in your journey, I think you get to a point at some point. And I speak to incoming MBAs every year at the University of San Francisco. I got my master's degree there. I left that out of my story, but, you know, I did get a master's at some point because I said, I want to do this for the rest of my life and I want to be great at it. And so I built a relationship with them. In the incoming class every year, I tell the MBA, I said, I know why you're here. I know you want to control your future more. You want to have more ammunition, career ammunition, and build more muscle to widen the opportunity spectrum for you professionally. That's great. I said, but please, please remember, we're here to finish happy, not first. And at some point, you know, there's no MBA in relationships, unfortunately. There's no MBA in joy. And so there's no master's degrees that prepare you to be a great person. And that's something that, you know, and I always joke with friends, like, why don't we have, like, what are the biggest decisions we make in life? Do you want a partner? And what does that partner look like? And what are the attributes? And how do you know it when you see it? And then do you want to have children? Those are probably, you know, where you want to go to school, if you want to go to school. My decision to go to college is so random in retrospect. It worked out. But what prepares you for those decisions? Like, is there, you know, it's your community, it's your network, your mentors and so forth. And you know, we have all the schooling, all these degrees for all these other things, but those are really big decisions. And I think what I want to, you know, just lay out there a little bit is, I think if you're just focused on your career as for a mentor, you're really marginalizing the opportunity. So I would, you know, I would suggest someone. And again, I also want to get into this notion of, you know, many mentors versus a mentor, because we're all changing and mentors are changing. And there's a woman I want to tell you about in a minute who's expanded what mentoring can look out at scale, which is kind of interesting. But I think it is really important to be grounded at the whole game is who you are. And, you know, the pandemic, which I'm not sure when we're going to air this, but we're probably still going to be in some dimension of the pandemic, has really created what I call this forced merger of home and life in ways that we've never seen before, creating a greater time and a greater need for us to grab on to people who help us make sense of this new craziness that we're going through. So another reason why I thought this conversation was really timely. But your point is that bringing up the life, not just the work, I think makes it a bigger, more meaningful conversation, and making yourself, you know, feeling comfortable to share your fears, your doubts, your concerns, to really get advice that helps versus, I don't want to look stupid because this person's really meant, I don't want to waste their time with my whininess about, you know, I'm not confident when I speak in a staff meeting or something, right?
Yeah.
But you got to do it.
You brought up the next part of the conversation, which let's dive into that a bit as far as mentoring at scale. Many organizations today are very much focused on growth and individual growth plans for their teams. As you said, there's a lot of career change happening right now, probably more career change and significant career change. People looking at themselves and their work lives and saying, I don't want to be doing this. I want to do something totally different. And the past year and a half has really opened up a lot of people's minds to thinking about what really makes them happy, what they're looking for out of work, what they're looking for out of personal reward, not pay, out of just like reward of the work that they're doing, feeling good about what they're doing. And that has inspired quite a bit of change in the world, especially the world of work. So bringing it back to organizations are very much focused on retaining their talent, retaining their culture and their people, and helping to grow and develop and provide individual opportunity for everybody that works at their organization, which is amazing. I think there are some incredibly positive and beneficial aspects that have come out in the world of work from what we've experienced over the past year and a half. And a big focus on that, or a big result, is this very specific focus on people within organizations. A challenge that organizations are facing is mentoring at scale, as you just said. And I know you have some thoughts on that, and also a personal story about a colleague of yours that jumped into this. But what are your thoughts on mentoring at scale within an organization, and maybe some challenges with that?
Well, I 100% agree with your thesis, which is this time has provided us an opportunity to really recognize that people need help more than ever, that the world that we're working in is less certain, it's more complicated, and things are changing, and everyone has a new relationship with their reality. What we had this really interesting thing happen at LinkedIn one time. Just talk about engagement for a second, and then I'll come back to the mentoring at scale part of the question. When the early days of LinkedIn, man, if someone left, it was like, oh, we lost, what? Someone's like, every departure, every turnover was like, you know, we're like a brutal divorce. Like, what? This can't be happening. You're going to leave me? And so we looked and we researched, we looked at the data, and this was before data was a thing. People analytics was a thing. And one day we stumbled on a correlation that the highest proportion of people who are leaving were first-time parents. And so we started like, really? What, like, do we just not have good parental leave? Are we not accommodating the life? And at the end of the day, we talked to these people after they left. And then we started to say, well, let's just go talk to people who've had a child for the first time. Let's talk to people who have many children. What's happening when you have your first child? Your life shifts. Where you want to be, how you think about life, who you want to spend your time with takes a massive hit. And on a different dimension, I believe the pandemic has served that to all of us. It's shocked us. It's been like this defibrillator, like, poof. We've had an electrical shock. The world hasn't settled yet. The ground is still soft. It's still moving. We're not stable. We have this new strain of the virus, and there'll probably be another one behind it. And we don't know how to deal with that. But I'm looking at my world of work differently. I'm not going to give up shopping at the store whenever I want to. I'm not going to give up not fighting with people on Saturday to get my hair cut. Thankfully, I still have hair to cut. You know, I want the freedom of my time with my family and my kids and not commuting. I'm not giving that up. And never before in history have we had a moment where that's happened. And I've tasted something, and I believe I've proven I'm as productive as I could be for the organization in this new dimension. Why are you asking me to come back? So forth. And so that's a whole nother thing. But it's also, as we touched on earlier, we can see more what's possible professionally and personally than ever before. So the need to have offer that at scale is growing. I'm on a panel at a conference coming up where we're debating coaching versus life coaching. And there's sort of, you know, what is life coaching, and should organizations offer life coaching versus just career coaching or, you know, job development coaching. And I had four of these amazing people. I'm the moderator of this panel. I'm just like, what do you want to talk about? And like, well, what does AI have to do with the future of, you know, this kind of coaching and so forth? But I think every organization philosophically will always agree this is important. But I've never been in an organization where mentoring at scale has been realized. I mean, which is an interesting reality. And I would love for someone to show, hey, look, over here, it's really working great. And it probably boils down to the fact that even though intellectually we all agree, yes, we need to do it, we should do it, it is a bit of a blind date in a way. Like, if you're trying to pair people, and the mentee may feel uncomfortable. And so you have to prepare the mentor, what you're going to get something out of it. The mentee, this is how you get the most out of it. You got to prepare those people, and then you arrange it. But then life gets in the way. Then things get busy. I postpone the meeting and things like that. I've never succeeded at doing it, you know, in any of the organizations I've been. And people say, well, we should do a mentoring program. I go, what are you asking me for? Just go find a mentor. You don't need my permission. Like, just go. Well, can you find me a mentor? I said, okay, what does it look like to you? So I've rolled around in it. I'm curious. I would love to, you know, listen to some more of the guests that you have if someone has pulled this off, so that we can all learn from it. But I think that's what I love about what I do is people are just so different and unique and changing. That's why I've never tried to, and not by design, but just why I've never had a mentor over a long period of time, because I'm ebbing and flowing and dealing with different things, and different people with different skills could help me at different points along the way.
That's a good way to look at personal mentorship, where there is not one solution that works for everyone. As you said, depending on where you've been in your life and where you've been in your career, you've had moments of mentorship, and you've also maybe had some shorter term mentorship relationships, but they've been impactful and meaningful and useful to you. On the other hand, I have a couple of mentors, but they have been long term mentors over, let's say, 10 years. But interestingly, my mentors all came out of the same work experience. I mean, at least there can be the connection of the interest and the ability to mentor in a certain area, but there's just so much of the personal relationship aspect of it. So I think it's a challenge.
Right. It is a challenge. And let me offer someone that I would strongly encourage you to connect with and maybe invite to this series.
Sure.
It was two women, actually. I came across these folks in a retreat I went to in the UK about 10 years ago. And I came across a woman named Zella King, and she has a business partner, Amanda Scott. And they've built this notion called the personal boardroom, which is a part of a study that they did over years, which said, hey, if organizations have boardrooms, what's the purpose of a boardroom? To fill in the gaps of expertise that you need to effectively lead and govern a company. And what they said was, well, why shouldn't each of us have a personal boardroom? And that would include things like someone to challenge you, someone outside your industry, someone who's got a shoulder to cry on, someone who's analytical and you're not analytical, someone who makes you feel good, you know, like someone who's a brainstormer. And they've identified, I can't remember what it is, like 12 to 15 dimensions of what that looks like. And that I always thought was fascinating. And I've promoted them to, you know, they were charging for it. And then they said, you know, we're just going to give this thing away for free because it's super cool. But it is a really, I think, compelling notion that can one person really serve our needs? Sure, in some really profound ways. But what could be more meaningful is all these different dimensions. And they're, you know, they're PhDs, so I'm not going to win a debate with them on this, but I trust the thinking behind that. And it resonates with me that, yeah, we should all. I know what a lot of listeners will think, like, I don't know that I could go, you know, hustle up, you know, 12 people. But I bet you, if you really sit down and think about it, and mainly I'm talking about someone who's probably 40 years plus, your network's expanded, you've worked in a number of different organizations, you know, different people, you probably have someone that maybe you haven't identified them as that person, but they might be there helping serve you when it's, you've got to pull up the MacGyver bat phone and say, hey, I'm in a jam. Can you help me think about this differently? Or how would you approach this challenge, this issue? Or I'm really in a low place right now and everything I see looks dark and negative. Like, well, help me. You know, I'm stuck. This is the thing that's interesting about the pandemic is, going into the pandemic, the number one talent concern most of my clients and friends are in talent world are concerned about is diversity, equity, inclusion. Well, that just got trumped by wellness and burnout and stress and anxiety, not just with work, with everything in life that you're like, I got kids and they can't educate and I've got to do work and I can't do all this stuff and I need to find toilet paper. There's a run on toilet paper. And so I like that notion that there are other, you know, there's a wider spectrum. But again, they've been doing this for years. And I thought this thing is going to just like a no-brainer. It's going to explode. And I don't see it taking off. It was a miss for me. Like that's something that we should all have something like that.
Steve, we are coming to the end of the conversation. First off, thank you for sharing your personal story of being a mentee, being mentored, and that really meaningful moment in your life when you made a significant change, which I'm sure can also be very scary at the time as well. And also just your perspective on what mentoring can look like for the future and the importance of really choosing a mentor. And if you are a mentor, focusing on that personal relationship and the ability to be yourself in that relationship to get the full reward out of it. Because mm-hmm. when we're our authentic selves in these type of relationships, that's where we're going to be able to be the most beneficial to have those relationships.
Mm-hmm.
Steve, I'm sure people in the audience listening to the episode are curious about you. We talked a lot about you individually, but you've had this amazing career and you do so much work. You work with so many big organizations right now as far as an advisor. How can people find out more about you? Where do they go?
Well, first, thank you for this conversation. And again, just completely reinforce the work that you are doing here, and these conversations are so meaningful. And I've become a podcast junkie during the pandemic. People want to find me. I have a website, stevecadigan.com. You can obviously find me on LinkedIn. I hear it's a pretty good website. I just launched a book around the future of work.
Yes, congratulations.
And it's called Workquake. Yeah, and it's embracing the aftershocks of COVID-19 to create a better model for working. I'm so excited about it. It doesn't have all the answers, but I do talk a lot about the psychological shift that the workforce is having today. And one of the provocative points I say, and this just underscores the value of why mentoring is really necessary and just essential today, is that I believe the workforce today, particularly the knowledge workforce, is moving from seeing career security as moving from being in one place to moving to many places. That I'm more secure the more I move, the more I meet new people, the bigger my network becomes, the more I know, the more knowledge I have, the more employable I become. And that being employable today is more important than being employed. And that means game on for employers. You want people to stay, you need to make them more capable of leaving and better for the future. And I love that because people are having to be creative. And I know you see this because you study this world as much as I do. In the world of tech, we've been fighting for talent for 20 years. In the non-tech world, they're having to fight for talent and they're on their heels. And when I see Burger King has a sign on their placard that says, "We all quit." And then I go to Las Vegas and I see $1,500 signing bonuses outside a bar. And then I hear on the radio, $50,000 signing bonuses for truck drivers. I know that, you know, the advantage is the employee right now, and employers are not sure how to handle it. And I think if you can supply someone with greater clarity for their personal journey, that's so much richer than only caring about them when they work for you. And so, you know, again, super excited to be here. It sounds like I'm going to need to come back because we only just got started, but I hope we have a chance to talk more.
I would love that, Steve. And I am excited to read your book, Workquake. Just recently came out. So
started shipping yesterday.
Congratulations.
When we're recording, actually.
Yeah, congratulations. Yeah.
So, yeah. Yeah,
which will only be a few weeks from when this will
Great.
Go live. So it will,
Great.
Those of you listening, we're recording in mid-August, but the book is out and should definitely check it out. But Steve, thank you for your insights, your time, your story. And I take you up on that continued conversation. We will have a chapter 2 of this discussion at some point. So thank you very much, Steve.
You're welcome.
And that was Be More, a podcast by Peakon. Be sure to search for Be More in Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify, or anywhere else that you get your podcasts from. And go ahead and subscribe so that you don't miss out on any future conversations. On behalf of the team here at Peakon, thanks for listening.